Yeah, I think Germany had more installed. I think install-wise, yeah.
She is an OSU graduate who went off to have a successful research career at Washington State University before coming back to OSU in 1999 to head the School of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science. She has published more than 100 technical papers in integrated circuits and innovative electrical engineering education. And she helped to co-found a new company, Azure Technologies, up in Tualatin, and was the CEO for that company for a short time. But she's back here with us to lead the School of Electrical Engineering and Computer Technology. We're delighted that she's here. And she'll be speaking tonight on solar energy's bright future. And she'll have two partners for the question and answer period. And she'll introduce them as well. So Terry,
okay. Thank
give
you.
Us a welcome for Terry.
Well, I'm a little nervous after that trivia quiz because you actually did very well. So no hard questions, please. So thank you very much for having me tonight. I'm really excited to be able to talk to you and have some exchange. And I have two helpers because the Q&A is always the hardest part. So I brought my reinforcements here. So I have Wolfgang Dilson, who's a builder in town, built a lot with solar, and also Walt Eager, who's my neighbor, and done a lot with solar, so I think there'll be good discussion afterward, and I appreciate both of them attending. And then also I want to recognize Sunwise for providing the show and tell for as we go along. So let's get started. So why is there interest in solar? Why are you here? And I think there's some things that have fundamentally changed, which have fundamentally piqued our interest in solar. So first of all, there's been unprecedented growth in population and urbanization. So people are moving back to cities. If we look at the world population here, you'll notice in about, well, today we have about, almost 7 billion people on the Earth, on the planet Earth. About 1.4 billion are Chinese, about 1.2 are Indian. And we have rapid growth. So if you look at from 1950, notice this big uptick. That has a significant impact on a lot of things that affect our lives. The other thing that's happened is, as you might know, there's been a significant change in China. And so if we look here, so first of all, back in 1950, there were about 70 million vehicles on the road. And in 1990, there were about 600 million. This is worldwide. The dark graph you see here is the US. And you'll notice the US has about half of the vehicles in the world. And in 2008, there were about 850 to 900 million vehicles worldwide. And there were about 55 to 60 million sold per year. Whoops. I thought there was one more thing. Oh, so just a couple other things. So one of the things that's interesting is in 1990, in China, you were not allowed to have a privately owned vehicle. So that was not very long ago, what, 20 years ago. Today, in 2008, China produced about 10 to 11 million vehicles. And we're not far off where they're going to be shipping the vehicles over here if they're not already. So this is a big shift overall. There's something changing here. Are you fixing it? Thank you. So this is really a change. We're used to the US sort of dominating this. China has 1.4 billion people. We have a big change that's about to emerge. So if we look at this is a hot topic, obviously, in the press, when we look at oil and gas and everything that's happening. The U.S. has a third of the world's vehicles and uses a quarter of the world's oil. And, you know, many people have said to me, oh, it takes subsidies to do solar and it's very expensive. We're going to be paying for this cleanup for the next 30 years. And it's going to impact our economy. It's going to impact everything. So we're actually paying a lot for the lifestyle that we live. The other thing is U.S. supplies 50% of its energy from coal, and we know that coal pollutes. China supplies 80% of its energy from coal. But why should we care about China, right? It's not here. They can do whatever they want. It turns out that it has a big effect on us. And I like this picture. I'm still getting a little bit of... Okay, we'll do it this way. This was, if any of you got to the lecture by Dennis Demick from the National Geographic, he's an executive director. He was here and he presented this picture, and I really liked it. And what you see is this little thing over here is the United States. And you'll notice there's these big fat lines coming from China to the United States, to Europe, and to China. And what that represents is it represents the net flow in millions of tons of carbon dioxide emissions. So in other words, our demand in the US for products, things, all these things we buy that are manufactured in China and then shipped back over to the US. So the fact that they're using 80% of their energy is from coal, we're causing that pollution in China, which is, you know, we're getting our products, but it's also polluting the world. And so we're actually at the source of that. And I thought that was a very interesting representation of the effect that we're having on the world. It's not just what we're doing here. Okay, so the world's over. Let's just end it right here. We're done. And so the question is, are we doomed? You know, about it, what, a year and a half or 2 years ago, we had a big economic drop, and, you know, everything was, the sky was falling. You know, we're in this recession and all of that. But in reality, I think there's a lot to look forward to and a lot to be positive about. And the key to this is really innovation. So innovation is really key to our future. And that innovation is what's going to provide us not only our energy security, but also our financial security. So that's what I'm going to talk about, is really give you a little bit of background on what is this solar stuff anyway? Is it something I should do? Is it too expensive? That type of thing. So the good news is, being in a university, we work with a lot of students, clean tech is cool. So now the students will come in and they say, I want to save the world. I want to work in clean technology. They have no idea what that means. They just know they want to do it. So that's good. They're motivated to help solve this. And so you'll see, like here, I've shown some wind out here, wave energy. OSU is one of the leading, probably the leading university in the United States in wave energy research. Solar, here's some solar employments. And then bioenergy, OSU also is a major contributor in the bioenergy. And one that I haven't shown here is nuclear. OSU is probably one of the top couple in nuclear with the nuclear spin out that we have there too. So the good news is, not only is it cool, but OSU is a hotbed for a lot of this. So why solar? I'm still getting a little bit of, you can't fix it. Closer? It's too loud. Okay, I'll whisper. I have a loud voice, so I shouldn't tell this, but I have four brothers, and in my family, if you talk the loudest, you win. That's good? Okay.
You're good.
Okay. So anyway, I wanted to win a lot. So why solar? It's free. And so on a bright sunny day, the sun shines about 1,000 kilowatt or 1 kilowatt of energy per square meter. Square meter's not really big. That's a lot of energy on that surface. So if we could just collect a small percentage of this, we could actually power our homes and our offices for effectively free. Okay, if it were only that simple, right? So how does solar work? And this is like the extent of the real technical parts, but just very simply, the sun shines and we have a piece of, in this case we'll say silicon, and photons, which is the energy that you get from that sun, causes charge to be excited in the material. So this shows the charges right here, the plus charges and the minus charges. And I'm an electrical engineer. What happens is you actually get current flowing here. And that current flow is what is the electricity that we then harvest. So that's the basic of how solar works. So there's a couple different ways that we can make solar cells or make solar collecting devices. And this shows kind of a cross section of what a solar device would look like. This is a solar cell. And when we talked about Solar World, they actually produce solar cells like this. And it's a monocrystalline, meaning single crystal. It's based out of silicon. And there are multiple layers here. The important layer is there's silicon there. There's a layer which is shown here, which is this wiring. So see those cross lines? That's just the wire, the electrical wire that's actually patterned in there. And then there's usually a nice cover on it to protect it. And there's a lot of different ways that's done. Now, this particular technology has an efficiency in the 15 to 22%. And so the question is, why do I care about that? Well, what that tells you is, it tells you how much you can harvest. So if the sun shines on it, it's only 15% efficient. That means you don't get nearly as much as you get if it's 22% efficient. So you're harvesting more for a given area. So this, I'm going to pull this off. So if we look over here, later on you can come here. This is a panel that Sunwise brought. And it's just a conventional monocrystalline panel. And you can look at it and you can see the little wires, just like you see there, and then the wires that go down the front. And that's how they connect the cells together. So that's just a monocrystalline. And then this is all put together into what's called a panel. So this is a solar panel. And I'm going to refer to this solar panel a little bit later about, you know, how many of these do I need on my roof? So we'll do my house as an example. Okay, there are other solar technologies. This is the one that's traditionally been installed. You see it in a lot of places. If you go to the Oregon Solar Highway, the Department of Transportation, as you go up I-5, the 205 I-5 part, it's monocrystalline, and you'll see all those panels there. Okay, there is also other technologies, and this is where the innovation is really playing. So not only are they increasing the efficiency of monocrystalline, the traditional approach, there are new ways that are being developed. So over on the left here is what's called polycrystalline. And you'll notice this is my favorite because it's really pretty. So you'll see that it's kind of patterned here, and it's an irregular pattern. And that's because it's not a single crystal, it's now a pattern of these, or polycrystalline. And this one, the reason you would want to do this is it's cheaper. You don't have to purify it as much, you don't have to do all this to get it nice and clean looking. And the efficiency is a little bit lower. So if you've ever heard of SpectraWatt, they're in Oregon. They actually were a spin out from Intel, and they're looking at using polycrystalline and making solar panels very cheap. So again, everyone's trying to reduce the cost. And then you've probably heard about some of these flexible thin film type technologies. So here's one where you actually can flex it. Here's one that's on a conveyor belt that's actually being manufactured. And there's a couple different technologies there. One's called CIGS, which is copper, indium, gallium, selenide, and then cadmium telluride. And those are two that are on the market now being produced. The cad telluride is First Solar, if you've heard of them, is what they produce. And one of the things they had to do, we kind of know that cadmium's not a great thing to put in things. So they have a cradle-to-grave plan, where if you put it on your roof and at 20 years later you want to retire them, they'll actually recycle them and handle the waste associated with that. So these technologies are in the range of about 8 to 15%. So the difference is, if I'm putting it on my roof and I have really limited space, I'll probably go with a monocrystalline panel. If I'm doing a big, huge installment, say for a utility, I've got lots of area, that's where these technologies can be very cheap or cheaper because I don't have a space limitation. Any questions at this point? I should have said if people had questions along the way, but otherwise we'll get to questions at the end. Anybody still awake? Okay. Yeah.
Is there a difference between a cell and a panel?
Cell and a
solar cell, the same thing as a panel in your language?
Oh, okay, no. So a solar cell, what I call a solar cell, would be one of these boxes here. So that's a solar cell, and the panel is, when we put them all together, that's a panel. Okay? And sometimes we refer to them as modules. Some people are really picky about that terminology. I sort of use them interchangeably. Okay, so here's a couple solar installations. These are big installations, obviously. And just to kind of show you the kind of things that are happening, there's three markets that really have emerged here. The first market is for the residential market, and it's typically in the 2 kilowatts to maybe 7 or 8 kilowatts, so it's not a big installment. Then there's commercial. Commercial would be on commercial buildings, typically. And those are more like 50 kilowatts to about 100 kilowatts. And then utility scale are big. So I don't know that we've done a lot of these in Oregon, but utility scale are more on the 1 megawatt and above, 20, 40 megawatts. So they get very large. And so this picture shows an example of what it looks like. And in effect, what you're doing is you're creating a solar power plant. So now it operates like a power plant. Yes, question.
Where is that one on the bottom?
I don't know. Oh, Wolfgang? What's that?
Chicago?
No, I don't know. This wasn't from the paper today.
It looks like
the one from the paper today, but it's not. I've had this on this slide for a while. And if you read the paper today, they were talking about how solar prices are coming down. I'll talk a little bit about that too. But I've had these on my slides for a while, so sorry. They're popping up all over. How's that? Okay, so we talked a lot about the solar cell and the solar panel. There's more to it than that. So everything but the solar panel is what's referred to as the balance of system. So it means everything else except the solar panel. And so you have things like the wiring. You have to worry about the wiring. You have a DC to AC converter. So the output from these is a DC voltage. Our houses run on AC voltages. So we have to convert that. We have to match that so that we can power something in our homes. Then there are combiner boxes to combine these cables and racking and mounting and other stuff. So just generally hardware racks that you have to put down to mount these and things like that. So that's kind of the overall system when we talk about a solar installment. Okay, I want to do a little tutorial and I'll show you what it is my company has been involved in. So if we look at the way that most solar is installed today, up here we have, here's the solar panels, and the sun is shining on the solar panels. And the output from this is a DC voltage. And remember I said we actually use AC in our homes. So we have this box, and that box is called an inverter. And the inverter converts that DC voltage, that straight flatline voltage, to a sinusoid. So it varies. And that allows us to either put that onto the grid or power your home directly. So that's the system today. Now, if you remember from the trivia test, what was the highest failing component? The inverter. Okay. So once we figured this out, it's like, okay, there's an opportunity. We can solve that problem. So basically, the way that the solar industry is trending, especially for home installations, is you have the solar panels here, and instead of going through this box that's maybe in your garage or your basement, why don't we treat this instead of having a mainframe, let's distribute it and put all these little computers on each one of the panels. And so the output that we have here is just an AC output. And that's what my company, Azure A Technologies, is doing up in Tualatin. So basically we put output out, and that's what's called a microinverter. So, you know, we were thinking about, okay, how do we advertise this in the future? Well, you can imagine, you know, having a big mainframe, and then you show this distributed intelligence, and that's exactly what's happening. Now what you can do is you can log in at home, and you could say, oh, how much energy is each panel producing? And why don't I have much out of that row of panels or that particular panel? All that intelligence is coming as really a part of the future of wider adoption. And I think part of this is that most people, if they put this on their home, they want some information. They're kind of geeky about the whole thing, and they want to know what's happening. So it's pretty exciting because that is the future, and that's going to happen. Now, I mentioned that the inverter is the highest failing component, and I won't go into lots of gory detail, but the bottom line is they have a particular kind of capacitor called an electrolytic capacitor, and it tends to fail, and it fails in about 7 to 10 years. So what we did at our company is we developed some algorithms and a new way of looking at this that we didn't need to use electrolytic capacitors. And that's really what the core intellectual property is that we've developed as part of our company. Okay, so is solar too expensive? Well, okay, it's still relatively expensive because remember, oil and gas really are subsidized. You know, if you think of the pipeline, we've already put a lot of money into that. We have to invest in new technologies, new renewable energy sources in order for them to become competitive. And that's what we're doing. So we do that a couple different ways. We have some government subsidies, and I'll talk a little bit about that, not too much. And then there's also tax credits. But before I go into all of that, let me give you a little bit of history of where solar has come from. Okay, this is a busier picture, but let me just kind of walk you through it. So on the left-hand side, we have really early stage technologies. And the early stage technologies are batteries and supercapacitors. We're still in the early stages of those technologies. Fuel cells, still early. We don't see fuel cells widely adopted at this point. Then we get into the growth phase. So technologies that are in the growth phase would be wave energy was one. Solar photovoltaic is another one. It's still in the growth phase. It's still very early overall in the technology of where it's going to be. Wind is much further along. You'll notice that now we see a lot of wind deployments, and actually from a cost point of view, it's come down. If you go to the gorge, you can see a lot of them. There's a lot of them you can't see. And then there are mature technologies. So coal is very mature, natural glass, gas, hydro, and then aging technologies would be nuclear and oil. So you can see that where we are on this growth curve for solar is very early on. What that means is that more innovation, more development is what's really going to make it competitive, and we're going to see it grow. Okay, so we asked this question about, and you can argue it, and it probably depends on where you are, but if we look at solar is this picture here. So you'll notice that solar peaks out about midday. That's when the sun usually is its highest, and we collect the most solar energy. And if we look at the green curve, this shows wind energy. So if you think about going to the gorge, it tends to be pretty windy in the evening. So actually, if you think about it as a renewable energy, combining the wind and the solar is a very complementary way to balance out your energy. This isn't true in every single case, but it's a good kind of generalization. And so then as we look at how do we keep the load constant, balancing these two would be one way to do that. Okay, let's do a little bit more history here. We're going to have, by the way, there's a test. Anybody tell you at the end? Okay. It's a little harder than the trivia one, but not too hard. Okay. So over here on the left, this is the starting material. Typically, it's polysilicon. So remember, it's multicrystalline silicon. And so you see pieces of that. What's happened is since the early 70s, that's basically come down by an order of magnitude to about $30 per kilogram. The ingot, what we do is we take this and we form it into ingot. So you actually grow this and you produce this big cylinder of silicon. Those have gone from 3 inches in diameter to now 8 inches and more. So if they got bigger, that means the cells can get bigger, and it means we can harvest more energy with each cell. And then what happens is we take the ingot and we slice it up into wafers. And they used to saw one at a time. That the wafers have gotten much thinner and as a result use less silicon, which means they're cheaper. And then we go to the solar cell. From these wafers, we actually cut them so they make them square because they would be round. And in the 70s, it was about a half a watt per cell. Now we have 3 watts per cell. So this cell that you see here is about 3 watts, each one of them. Okay, and then we go to the solar module, and the solar modules used to be about $100 per watt. Today, we're down into the almost $2 a watt, so they've really come down in price, okay? Almost two orders of magnitude. And then finally, the systems, when we look at systems, they used to be about $200 per watt. Now we're looking at $7 per watt. So definitely the prices have come down, and even recently, in just the last year, prices have come down a lot. One of the things I can share is that when we were talking to people a year ago, this was kind of after the downturn, but hadn't really hit anybody, most people were like, we don't need to talk to you. We can sell more than we can build. Well, it turns out that there was so much ramp up in manufacturing, and then with the market going down, so there's less financing, there's a lot more competition. All of a sudden, companies are looking for innovative ways to differentiate their products. So again, it's going to lead to new and better things.
Can you tell me roughly what the average home uses in
watts? I'll get to that. Okay. If my home is average, we'll know.
Okay,
I'm not sure it's average, but we'll try that, yeah. I'm saving the best for last, okay? All right, so some recent milestones. So Bonneville Power, this is a picture of Bonneville Power. Bonneville Power produces 1 gigawatt of energy, or gigawatt, well, it's not energy, but anyway, it's 1 gigawatt. And in 1999, we finally hit 1 gigawatts worldwide. So in 1999, it took us from the early 70s to 1989 to hit the equivalent of 1 Bonneville Power. That's pretty amazing, I think. Okay, but in 2001, there were more square inches of silicon used than in the entire microelectronics industry. So, you know, Oregon's done a lot with microelectronics, Intel, companies like that. Well, a lot of the silicon started to be used for solar rather than for chips, which is kind of interesting. It's a shift. In 2004, there was 1 gigawatt production during that year. So if you look at that, from 1999 to 2004, we basically started producing as much as we had built up to that time. Pretty amazing growth. And there's more tons of silicon used than in microelectronics at this point. And the market overall is growing about 40% a year, year after year. It's been about 6 years now. Pretty significant growth. So it's a good place to be if you have a startup company. All right, so I'm getting a little technical here, but I like this curve. I'm sorry, I'm an electrical engineering professor. I have to show this, okay? But if any of you are familiar with Moore's Law, have you heard of Moore's Law? It's been in the press. And basically what Moore's Law tells us, as we keep doubling the number of transistors on a chip, the prices have gone down, right? Your handheld devices have gotten cheaper. Guess what? That applies to solar. And what this shows here is this is the cumulative production, thank you, and this is the module price. And as we produce more, the prices have come down. And that reduction is it drops about 20% with each doubling in the manufacturing capacity. So basically, we want to grow the capacity. That's going to draw the price down. So anyway, for those, any of the geeks in the audience, you might like that. And the other thing is, currently, my son, as I was leaving, he's like, well, who cares about solar? It's less than 1% of the production of energy in the world. He's like, thank you very much. he's 15. But the projections are we'll be at 9% by 2030. So it is increasing, and this 40% growth a year is really feeding that. I'm going to skip this one. Okay, so a little bit more history, because again, I think this is kind of interesting. All right, do you remember Jimmy Carter? Put your sweater on and turn down the heat, right? And he invested in a lot of renewable energy. I remember this, you know, and then somehow it all went away, right? So what happened? What?
In one day.
In one day it went away. Wasn't that amazing? So if we look back in the 70s, There was a big surge of activity, and there were a bunch of small startups, and these small startups were innovating because we had to look at renewable energy. And so there was rapid growth, and there was the development of technology. A lot of good things were happening. And then what happened is you'll notice that these oil companies started buying a lot of the solar companies. So between the 85s and the 95, a lot of the solar company or the energy companies or oil companies started to buy into this. There was moderate growth, but a lot of the incentives just weren't there for growing it. Then between 1995 and 2005, that's when the Japanese really started getting into this. So the Sharps, the Sanyos, the Kyoceras, you'll see them everywhere if you look into solar. And it really started the emergence of the residential roof market, and there was a lot of improvement in manufacturing. That's what the Japanese brought to it. And then from about 2000, it became the entrepreneurial phase. And so we're really big time into that. A lot of venture capitalists started investing here. Qcells is a company in Germany it just exploded. Solar World, another German company that's in the United States. Evergreen Sun Power. And from OSU, there's two currently. Azure Technologies that I was involved in co-founding. And then Extreme Energetics, John Wager's here. You want to raise your hand? John developed, what did you develop? No, They did some really neat work on transparent electronics. In other words, you can see through them. And what Extreme Energetics has done is they're licensing that. And instead of, for some solar panels, they're doing mechanical tracking. What they're doing is electronic tracking. So they're taking those see-through electronics and they're actually sort of moving the cell to optimize the harvest of energy. Pretty cool stuff. That company's down in California, but John's one of the key developers on that. So there's explosive growth and a lot of technology evolution. So it's very exciting, a very exciting time. So solar makes sense, right? Well, it does, but we've got to continue to innovate. We've got to continue to reduce the cost, and we've got to continue to increase adoption. All right, so I'm not going to talk about that. We'll go on here. So what about the cost and benefit of solar? And I thought I'd do this little table because I couldn't figure out another way to represent it, but it's kind of interesting. So if you look at Portland, Oregon, you can generate from one panel like this, just like this, about 252 kilowatt hours per year. Okay, pretty interesting. Well, Palm Springs, you get about twice that amount. That was one of the trivia questions. Of course, the sun shines a lot more than it has here the last 4 months, right? But the interesting thing is, if we look at the cost of energy, Oregon has some of the lowest energy in the nation, 7 cents a kilowatt hour, and actually it's probably a little less than that. My bill said about 7. Palm Springs is about twice that. New Jersey is about twice that. So even though New Jersey wouldn't harvest a lot more energy from the sun for a single panel, their electricity rate is more than 2 times what our electricity rates are. So it makes it like the return on investment significantly shorter. And then if we look at Flagstaff, Arizona, you would think that Flagstaff would just have, you know, an infinite amount of energy produced. But these panels actually, if they get too hot, don't harvest as much energy. So there's a heat factor there. So basically, Oregon produces half as much solar electricity as Palm Springs, while electricity cost is half. And as a result of that, what we've seen is people want to manufacture in Oregon. It's expensive to grow this silicon. You have to have very high temperatures. It uses a lot of energy. And that's why you see these companies moving to Oregon. Plus, they have very good state incentives. Any questions on that one? Thank you. So solar incentives. So generally, if you go to put this on your roof, there's a federal tax credit of about 30% of your system cost. It's pretty good. How many things do you get 30% tax credit? Oregon state tax credit is about $3 a watt. Remember I said it's about $7 or $8 a watt installed? It's pretty good. There's almost half of your cost, up to $6,000. PacifiCorp will pay you $1.50 per watt as a cash incentive, and Consumers Power will pay you 50 cents per watt cash incentive. And then recently there was a feed-in tariff, and the feed-in tariff is you basically get paid for producing energy at a higher rate than you pay to use it off the grid. And Heidi was just telling me that they capped it at, how much? I forgot. How much they capped it at, I read that on the...
100 kilowatts.
So there was about 100 kilowatts of capacity that they would give this feed-in tariff, and it was gone in 9 seconds?
9 minutes.
9 minutes, okay. So you had to be on your computer, I think, ready to hit the, you know, return key.
Are you going to talk about the hidden costs with the feed-in tariff at some point?
I'm not going to go into all that.
Okay.
We can do that afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah, Heidi's going to cover that. We could go on forever on that. And then, but what they had was they were paying 65 cents a watt. Okay, we pay 7 cents a watt, they're paying 65. Wow. So when I was in Germany a year ago at one of the solar shows, we rode the train to the show where it was a couple hours. And it was really interesting because you'd see these barns and you'd see all these solar panels on all these barns. And what's happened in Germany is the farmers are starting to farm solar. And what they would do is they'd call up and they'd say, hey, my panels aren't producing today, you need to come out and fix them. And they got, because they have a feed-in tariff, and that feed-in tariff, they start to pay attention about what they're doing and how much money they're making. So it's pretty interesting. This roof right here, this is not just any roof. This is Walt Eager's roof, and Walt lives just next door to me. And Walt has two types of panels here. So this is the roof you see here. And what he has is at two ends, he has thin film panels, so those lower efficiency ones. And in the middle, he has monocrystalline panels and that are higher efficiency. So you'll notice that the area here and here is about twice what this is. And they produce about the same amount of energy, and because these aren't nearly as efficient. So there's an example from, you know, nearby. Okay, so what can solar do for me? And I took my own home as an example. So if we take the fees annual electricity use, it's about 18,000 kilowatt hours. Okay, I just looked at my power bill and got that. Now, just to qualify this, so you can kind of compare maybe for your own case, the house is about 3,000 square feet. We have a gas furnace, so we're not using it for the gas furnace. And we have a gas, stovetop. We do have an air conditioner, and due to allergies, we use that copiously, so many months of the year. So I'm like doing a confession here. And we have two teenagers. So there are countless loads of laundry, and our dryer is electric, and there's a never-ending opening in the refrigerator. So it pretty much stays open, okay? And at any given time, there might be 10 teenage boys at our house. Okay, so you kind of get the picture. So to fulfill all of our electricity needs, I just took a panel like this, about 200 watts, and said, how many do I need on my roof? And in my roof, I need 71 panels. That's a lot of these. See the size? We need a lot of them. Okay, but we're pretty big electricity users. You know, when the kids get out, they'll be on someone else's electricity bill. So then I said, well, if we had a flat roof, which we don't, but if we had a flat roof, I could fit 200 panels approximately on that roof, just assuming they're laying flat. And so I'd need a third of the roof facing south. Okay, and this is kind of a best case scenario. So the reality is I'm not going to completely cover my solar, my energy needs or electricity needs, but as Walt reminded me, once you get this on your roof and you're watching it, pretty soon your use goes down. So actually there's an effect that happens there. So we might have to do that and see what happens. And it turns out my house has very little south-facing roof, so we couldn't do nearly that. Now, if there's a feed-in tariff, which I no longer can qualify for, and I was in the wrong, you had to be in PGE's realm and we're consumer powers, at 65 cents a watt with 71 panels, I could generate $11,000 a year. Would have been nice. Versus our electricity bill is probably $1,000 a year, something like that. Heidi?
The feed-in tariff opens up
October 1st. Okay, it's like the lottery. Be ready and be at your computer. Oh, lower range. 65 cents is crazy. I think in Europe it's been about 40 cents a kilowatt hour or something like that, and I thought that was crazy high. 65 cents is really crazy. And the reality is they would never let me do this, but I just wanted to kind of exaggerate the case. So what about Oregon? What's Oregon doing here? So I thought I'd put together a list of companies and see how's this affecting us economically. We're number 3 in the nation for unemployment. We need to do some things to get people to work. So Solar World, I think they located here, it was about a year and a half ago is what I remember, almost 2 years ago. I remember going up to their opening. And they produce solar cells, so they make these cells. And they're in Hillsboro, and they have about 650 people. And by the end of 2010, they'll have about 1,000 people employed. And these skills are very similar to what people who had worked at Intel would have done in a manufacturing line. Peak Sun is another one that's closer to home in Albany, Oregon, and what they're doing is polysilicon. So they're actually manufacturing the polysilicon. The target was 500 by 2011. I don't know that they're on track for that, but this is the information that Bruce Laird from Economic Development gave me. Solex actually was one that was from California and moved up, and they've done well. They do the ingots and the wafers. And in Portland, they employ about 180 people. So that's a good success story. Sanyu Solar, maybe you've seen that in the paper. And they're doing ingots and wafers, and they're going to be in Salem. So they're, if I understand it right, they're taking one of the existing buildings. I forgot who was there. And they're reconditioning it. And they're expecting to have 200 people employed by the end of 2010. PV Power does the big microinverters. And they're in Bend, and they have about 65 employees. And one of the few made in the USA vendors. And it goes on. And so you'll see that this has been a productive thing for Oregon. And we've had incentives to help bring companies in to help, with getting more people employed. And like I said, my company, Azure Technologies, we're doing microinverters. We have about 25 people employed up in the Tualatin area. Any questions on that? Yes. So what she said is her husband was unemployed from HP and got a job at SolarWorld. And currently up at SolarWorld, they just make the cells. And their plan is to go to panels. I don't think they're doing panels yet.
No, they will be, though.
Yeah, they're...
So September,
they'll actually be making these full modules. And what they were doing is they were actually... making the cells and sending them down to Camarillo, California. And part of the reason they would do that is the biggest markets in California. So if you're going to ship something big around, you probably want it to be close to the market. Okay, so that's kind of a summary of that. So if we look at Oregon overall, and where do we play in this? If you think about it, traditionally we've been a forestry-based industry. And we saw a lot of that go down, 20, 25 years ago. And then we sort of got the reputation of Silicon Forest. So that was the Intels, the HPs, the world, and all of that. And now we're sort of moving into the solar forest, where really solar is a great opportunity for us in terms of jobs, with companies being recruited here and also created here, but also in terms of deployment of solar. I think Oregon's about number 6 in the nation. So even though we don't have a lot of sun, there's basically a lot of appetite for that, and we've seen that. So that's the end of my presentation, and at this point, it would be a good time to ask questions. Thank you. So you have a question here, and I'll try and repeat it.
If you put a solar panel on your house, does it replace the existing roof, or does it go on top?
It needs to go on top of the roof. Yeah, there's some really interesting what's called built-in photovoltaics, BIPV, and they're looking at some really interesting things where it becomes the roof. Those are still futuristic, but there's some really interesting technologies where it's into the tile or it's in part of the roofing material. So it's definitely down the road. Who's next? Right here. Okay. Walt, do you want to come up and ask, or maybe Wolfgang knows too. Walt, do you have an answer for, is moss an issue? He's had his, you've had it in what, 2 years?
Yeah, a little over 2 years. We actually go up there and flush it off not more than 2 or 3 times in the summer. And it's a fairly simple job to do that. Now when there are a few birds around, then I take a little brush, and while I'm hosing it, push the brush up and down. It's nothing hard. And the maintenance, other than just keeping it clean, because the rain does most of it for you most of the year, the rest of it just is almost maintenance free.
Well, that's the surface of the solar panel.
Yeah.
What about under the panel?
Does
under
it
the
panel.
Moss and things.
Yeah, you do. I flush under there too. To kick that off, but I put in a metal roof. Now metal roofs are more costly than the other, but it gives you the security of not having any penetrations through there. Penetrations, incidentally, are well done so that they don't leak. But I put a metal roof in there for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a really long life roof, and it will outlast the tent solar panels by a long shot. And it also, I could put white up there, and the white color actually keeps the heat levels down.
I was going to mention one other thing I didn't mention. I'll get to more questions, I promise. If you have a row of these panels, which normally on your home you might have 8 or 10 of them, something like that. And a tree shades one of them. With today's system, you will lose the whole row. And that's one of the other advantages of the microinverter, is it decouples those from the other. So if one is shaded, you'll just lose the energy from one of those. So that's another thing that, as you put it near your home. Yes, question.
So if the drive for this source of energy is escalating population, isn't the cure behavior and birth control rather than more technology?
So actually, I was just showing the trends that we do have happening, and yes, I agree. And actually, one of the biggest major efforts going on right now is energy efficiency. So I was involved in a proposal this fall that was on energy efficiency and creating an energy efficiency hub. It's $130 million. The DOE, Department of Energy, is establishing this to look at R&D about how do we take existing buildings, structures, homes, and significantly reduce our energy. Because even with this, if we don't reduce our energy use, we have a train wreck waiting to happen. So,
right, but if we double our efficiency and quadruple our population, we've lost.
Yeah, I can't solve that one today. I promise. Okay, we'll go right here.
Yeah, is there been any progress with things like solar steam roof, actually solar panels?
Yeah. That's the built-in solar photovoltaics. And you know, when you go to shows, you'll see a lot of these. I haven't seen it deployed extensively, but you'll see some you know, in other places, not so much here, but it's still early on.
Is there any progress made, like in solar paint, like you take your house or your car?
Have you looked at this, Wolfgang?
There's solar tile,
yeah, but I don't know about the paint. I mean, definitely people are talking about this. There's one of the startup companies, help me with the name, John.
Impria
is actually looking at printing exactly that idea. So you would print solar materials. So it's futuristic, but it'll be coming at some point in time. Yes. So when do you break even from your solar installment? And let's say it's on your home. If you were in Southern California, I think you'd be looking at about 6 years. Up in Oregon, probably closer to 12. But with this feed-in tariff, that changes it very significantly. It'll reduce that probably in half, even if they reduce the price on that. Walt, do you want to?
Back in 93, I put a solar water heater on my house. And at that time, I figured the payback period was going to be about 6 years. Because the price of energy went up, there was what I call a payback compression. In other words, the years kept getting shorter and shorter. And that's what you're going to see here, too, is that as energy prices go up, those payback periods are going to shrink really fast.
Question back here. Yeah.
This is the 90s.
Yep.
The second thing is, when we did get a metal roof on our house, we were told by the roofers we agreed that we took the PV off the roof and put it, we built a structure on the ground. And we found it much more satisfying to have, because we had the space to do it.
Yeah.
We found it much more satisfying to have it at ground level, and we could wash them off, easily covering their legs. And though we felt,
yeah, you'll see those kinds of installments if people have space, so it's not uncommon.
Right?
What's that?
You don't have to mow.
Yeah, that's right. the other thing he brought up was the solar water heaters. And if you look in China, those have been really, really well used. And part of the reason is the solar water heaters are significantly cheaper than they are in the U.S. So there's been pretty wide adoption in China for the solar water heaters, more than you'll see here by far. You were just in China. Do you want to say anything about it?
Yeah,
Come on up, Wolfgang. He has so much to say. Okay, more questions then. Okay, in the back. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that we went down to the solar highway and looked at those, and they don't clean them, but they stay really clean because it rains in Oregon, by the way. So actually here, this panels stay fairly clean. So I can believe that you wouldn't need to do anything. And in dustier, drier areas, they definitely need to clean them. Okay, yes. I think the way it is built, they are on the hook for that. So, the question was, for these cadmium telluride panels, is there any governmental force that's overseeing? So if this company, First Solar, which is a huge company, goes bankrupt, who recycles those in 20 years? So I don't know that I know the exact answer to that, but you know, definitely there's a recycle program. So it may not be foolproof. Question right here. Yeah, does Oregon currently export electricity? I don't know the answer to that, so I won't make up an answer, but my guess is, as I make up an answer, that we export some, but because hydro, we've been pretty secure up here in the Northwest. But I think, you know, we are effectively doing that. If you look at the wind turbines on the gorge now, we're exporting electricity in effect. Yeah. Question in the back here. That's a tough one. I was talking to an installer in Eugene about what do you do, and Wolfgang probably has an opinion here, but if you get off the kind of ideal angle, you do get a pretty significant loss in what you can harvest. So one possibility is you could put them at the side, but I think you might have some issues when the wind blows. Wolfgang, have you done anything with this?
You can put racks up there.
Come on up. You can't talk down there.
Actually, I'm not an installer, so you should call one of
Hold
the many.
The mic.
Hold the mic.
You should call one of the many installers here in Corrales or Eugene and find out what they can do for you. One of the obvious, easy solutions would be to put it in your backyard. You film there. Or you build some racks on the roof, which are above your roof line, and whatever you want. I mean, there are many possibilities.
So you're, yeah.
I can address that some. On my house, we have them facing due west. On my office, they're facing due south. In the summer, like today, we get more power on our home with them facing due west than we do.
Okay, so it's seasonal. Okay, then you say something. Stay here. Okay, Wolfgang wants to say something, so I'll let him talk for a minute.
Actually, I have so much to say that I think I'm going to have another science talk. Just a moment.
All right, now.
Please. Because I would like to talk about the fact that what solar panels are doing is just the cream of the cream on the cake. It's just the icing on the cake, I meant. It's just a part of the solar energy we have available. People, you've got to realize you are standing, you're walking, you're living on the greatest energy source at all, solar energy that is. That's the ground. You're walking on ground right now that is 53 degrees, constant energy, doesn't take any wind, doesn't take any sun, it doesn't take the daylight, it doesn't take anything except take it from the ground. So as a builder, I'm building houses from the ground up. So the total package of having an energy efficient home is to have a ground source heat pump, geo exchange. Any questions on that?
Okay, yeah, here's a question.
Yeah.
What's it going to cost if I want to replace my current system?
You mean your solar panels?
No, no, my heat system.
Okay.
My HVAC.
I don't know. I'm building new houses. outfitting existing homes with a ground source heat pump is more of a challenge. Like you well know, any remodeling job is more expensive than building new. The bottom line is this. Ground source heat pumps, 53 degrees, free for the taking. You kick it up 20 degrees and you have 70 degrees in your home. In the summer, you reverse the flow of that liquid, you pump into the ground, you take 100 degrees out of your ground, out of your house, cycle it into the ground, and cool it down to 53 degrees. There, theoretically, it's sort of like a heat sink, store it, not necessarily store it, all of it, obviously, because it dissipates in the ground, and in the winter, you bring it back up again. Now, that heats and cools, the solar system doesn't heat and cool. The bottom line is the wind system is inefficient and kills all the birds up there. I hate the looks of those damn things up there. So anyway, the bottom line is if you have just enough land underneath your house, maybe 10, 15, 30 feet apart, you can have some holes drilled into the ground and put in any length of pipe you want, depending on how far you want to drill. Anyway, it gets involved. If you want to have answers to all of this, go on my website. Corvallis Green Homes, corvallisgreenhomes.com. I have some links on there. Please know that the ground source heat pump is 70% more efficient than other electric systems. If you want details on that, I can hand this out here. I haven't tried
it.
I had a study done by a very informed electrical engineer. It's on the back of this page here. If you're interested, hand it around. We compared four different heating and cooling systems.
Okay, so you know, to talk to Wolfgang, and he's passionate about this, in case you didn't notice. Yeah.
The bottom line is this. The total package of an energy-efficient home is a ground source heat pump and a solar system and a solar hot water system.
There you go. Okay, how are we doing time-wise? More questions? Yeah, oh, we got a question way over here. Okay. The microinverter. That's a good question. Right now, the microinverter's a little more. Over time, that definitely is going to drop, and it simplifies the installation, so installation cost is less. And also, if you have any shading, it allows you to harvest more energy. So was that vague enough? But it's kind of a lot of, you have to look at it. I think for residential, it is going to be the way that things will go. And the big issue has been proving the reliability. So, you know, we spent a lot of time looking at reliability, not only coming up with algorithms to make sure that it was reliable, but also in terms of verifying that through testing and characterization and all of that. Question?
What fraction of the solar panel is the silicon as opposed to all the other elements needed to get the energy?
Yeah, so if we go back to the panel, what fraction of the solar panel actually harvests energy? Cost. So the solar panel's around half. It's about half of the total cost, something like that. So it's a pretty substantial, half to a third. So it's a big portion of it. Yeah, definitely. Question?
You showed in one of your figures a little blip based on silicon shortage. Do you see other raw materials as well as silicon?
Well, so let me give an example of, I didn't talk about that, but it was pretty interesting when we were starting the company. there was a shortage of starting material to grow the cells and all of that. And because of that, you know, it was like who owned a polysilicon factory to get theirs? And there was kind of a shortage worldwide. It was affecting integrated circuits and it was affecting solar panels. Well, then there was a huge growth in terms of manufacturers that were going to produce polysilicon. Well, that happened, and then there was a glut. This all happened within a couple years. So, you know, we always have that possibility of that happening, but it was really interesting because when that other volume came online, then it started putting pressure on the module makers to figure out other ways to differentiate their products. So we'll have different cycles like that, but it was kind of interesting because it affected the integrated circuits too. So it affected the chips in your cell phones and other things. Yeah, today, I skipped that slide, but today about 80% of the solar modules are out of silicon. So these are silicon cells, yes. Question?
You mentioned earlier that it takes a lot of electricity. That's why it's made. It's made from solar panels, is why a lot of companies are moving forward.
Yeah.
Considering the amount of electricity and the amount of water it takes also, and treated water.
Yeah. When do you recover it?
When does that all get recovered?
Okay, correct. So the question was, it takes a lot of electricity to produce these solar cells and to make that, and that's why they locate in Oregon. We talked about that earlier. So the question is, what's the payback? How soon is that? And I've seen some numbers, and I want to say in the 4-year time frame, something like that. So one of the companies I didn't talk a lot about was Evergreen Solar, and Evergreen Solar is in Massachusetts, and we visited their solar plant, and they have a really interesting ribbon technology where they pull these ribbons out, and then they cut them, and they go from polysilicon beads to panels out the door in the United States, not in China, within about 2 hours. So they start with polysilicon beads, and a panel goes out the door on a truck. And that was kind of part of what they were selling. The problem is they started having financial problems because they were invested in by, Lehman Brothers? Lehman, yeah. Bad news, kind of affected their price, their stock, and a few other things. So, you know, we'd like to see more of those things. I think we need to be innovative that way. Go, Walt.
The energy payback for the laminate
or no silicon. So what Walt said is the laminate, which is that flexible one I was talking about. Here's, if you want to come up and look, you can look at this. This is one in a frame, but it's that thin film technology. The payback, Walt was saying, was about 2 years for processing this. So it's significantly less.
Any other questions?
Okay, so feel free, you know, Wolfgang would love to talk to you. and Walt's happy to share his stories too, and I'll be here too. So thanks again for coming. We really appreciate it.